So welcome everybody to the Spring of Sustainability. It's a production of Shift Network and the Sustainable World Coalition. And today's session is dedicated to our love of water. And we're going to be discussing local actions that matter to express our love of water. So I'm Renee Soule. I'm your host for the day. I'm the Director of Virtual Learning for Sustainable World Coalition. And I'm also an eco-psychologist, which means that I'm devoted to the inner journey of sustainability, which is a verb in my world, and our commitment, our growing commitment to be a citizen of this earth. And I'm very excited to introduce our special guest today, Brock Dolman, Laura Allen, and Brad Lancaster, who's going to be showing up soon. So hello, Brock and Laura.
Hi, Renee.
Hey. Hi, Laura.
So, hi, Renee.
Hey. So I'm going to, and so Brock, I'm going to start with introducing you, which is hard to describe who you are. You're famous for showing up at various important municipal meetings dressed as a salmon or another, as you call, biological doppelganger. And so you currently live the dream that so many of us have of being in an intentional community that's attuned to the land and changing culture via various transformative education programs. So it's just so great that you're doing it. So I don't know if you'll speak much to that, but you're certainly welcome to. And you, for me, embody so much the can-do spirit that's required to make sustainability a way of life. So for more information about Brock's work, please go to oaecwater.org. So that's Occidental Arts and Ecology Center at water.org. So, welcome, Brock. So,
yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, great. And then Laura, I met Laura. she was my son's fourth grade teacher at Berkeley Montessori School. And I remember just being so thrilled to hear that you stopped doing, I mean, even though we loved you as a teacher, you dropped out of that work to devote yourself full time to harvest, you know, Gray Water Action. You founded Gray Water Action, which is an organization working in urban habitats to support people and kind of do-it-yourself, you know, create a system in your own house that cares for water and diverts it to the garden. It's wonderful work. So you have an upcoming book called Water Wise Home, How to Conserve and Reuse Water in Your Home and Landscape. It will be chock full of all kinds of practical ways to care for water, even in our urban habitat. You currently live in an eco-village in L.A. and are doing gray water work down there. So welcome. Laura.
Yeah.
Great. And Brad is not here yet, so we'll introduce Brad when he comes. Well, let me just introduce Brad so when he shows up, we're ready for him. His work is takes place in the deserts of Arizona in Tucson, and that's really in so many ways the front line of caring for water because they are in a tenuous situation out there in the desert. So he lives in a sort of oasis in the middle of the city, oasis-like demonstration site, which with his brother and neighbors in downtown Tucson, Arizona. And it's on an eighth of an acre, and it's surrounded by, streets and everything. And there he harvests 100,000 gallons of rainwater every year with less than 12 inches of rain falling from the sky. So it doesn't even end there. He also harvest the sun and the wind and shade and the fertility of the land in the desert. So to know more about him, go to harvestingrainwater.com to look at his books and also to learn more about how to work with dry lands. He even has a few songs on there about our love of water. So, and I forgot to mention Laura's website where you can get more information. It's called graywateraction.org. And there's also a lot of information on her site as well. So to begin our conversation today, first of all, just if you want to flesh out the introductions with some personal experience of how you got to where you are right now, sort of what awakened your commitment to water. Tell us more about, an early time in your life when that happened. Brock, do you want to start?
Sure. I come to water basically as a biologist, and my earliest photos are me in a Japanese rice paddy, elbow deep in trying to catch tadpoles, and just spent a life pursuing other life forms as a biologist. And I think at some point the recognition came upon me that no water, no life, that all life as we know it is mostly water, although it's carbon-based, and that ultimately we don't live on planet Earth, we live on planet water, and in fact, planet water, what's unique about it is that life is endemic, only occurs on this planet in the known universe, and it's water-based life. And so to really be someone who is a lover of life, I felt compelled to really dedicate my life to a fundamental molecule, this magic Mickey Mouse molecule of H2O that is so incredible in its phase states of solid and liquid and gas that creates conditions conducive for life.
There you have it. So what about you, Laura? How did you get into this, into caring for water?
I grew up in Northern California where there's plentiful water. It's very green and get usually lots of rain. And I grew up with a neighborhood water system where there was an artesian spring that fed a tank and supplied all the water in our neighborhood, this kind of semi-rural street. And my dad was a caretaker of that water system. And so if a neighbor left their hose on overnight or a water pipe broke, it would run the tank dry, and we would literally, like, temporarily not have that water supply. So it was normal to have this very immediate feedback of how we care for the water. There are consequences, and we all knew where it came from. We knew where it went. We were on septic systems. And then I moved away to go to college at UC Berkeley, and I studied environmental science, and I lived in the Bay Area for 5 years before I realized that I had been disconnected from my water supply, the water I drank and used every day. And the way I kind of became aware was by getting a water bill for the first time as a renter. As prior houses, I had never seen a water bill, and my communal household of seven got this water bill for the first time, and we were totally shocked. First, we had to pay for it. That was kind of out of our experience. And then none of us had any idea where the water came from, and it was definitely a kind of a rude awakening that all of us, our whole household, many recent college graduates, had no clue of what was going on with our water system, and we were all uncomfortable with that. And our response was, well, at least we can take back control of the water flowing through our own house and build a gray water system. So that was the beginning of my gray water education, self-taught at the beginning.
I remember just being, you're going to be speaking about this later, but just being shocked at how much water we use in our house every day. So that might have been part of the shock, too, I imagine, when you looked at the water bill. Like, really?
For sure.
So Brad, you're here, and welcome.
Thank you.
Yay. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how you just became such a water devotee. What were some of your earlier steps in that direction?
Well, I grew up in the desert community of Tucson, Arizona, and as a kid, my favorite pastime was building elaborate civilizations in the sandbox and then flooding it and totally destroying the civilization. And that game was awesome, but quickly banned when my parents got the extremely high water bills. So we had to get creative, and we had to start to work in balance with the rain patterns of the area. So preceding the summer rains, we would build these elaborate civilizations in the sand of the arroyos, the dry waterways. And then when the monsoon rains came, the biblical flood surged through and destroyed everything far better than a garden hose could. And that was just bliss. So we would pray for rain so we could play our game. And then that led to more water games. And then many years later, after college, kind of similar to what Laura was describing, I slowly started to become more in tune with where does my water come from, what's the infrastructure behind that, and what role can I play to enhance the local waters rather than deplete them. And after spending some time actually in the Sebastopol area of California doing some organic farming out there, I came back home wanting to do organic gardening and farming back here, and realized, wow, this is not going to be sustainable if I can't figure out the water situation. And I started to research the traditional Tona Autumn rainwater harvesting methods and whatnot, and tried to mimic those in my backyard garden and neighborhood street tree plantings. And what was great about that is, once again, I found myself praying for rain, running out in the rain with a shovel, just as I had as a kid, but this time not to observe the destruction of a civilization that I had created in the sandbox or the arroyo, but this time to actually enhance and help lift up the water awareness and the planting of the rain and what we could grow from it by, rather than draining the rain off our property and neighborhood streets, harvest it and grow food-bearing native perennial vegetation and more. And then to do it in such a way that I can entice the neighbors to do the same.
As you're speaking, I'm just realizing that human beings are not only the animals that know how to plant trees and to create, you know, grow food, but we're also the animals that know how to control and preserve and care for water. It makes us pretty unique. And so just imagine you as a kid figuring that out, you know.
We're only as unique as if we can, I was going to say, if we apprentice ourselves with beavers, then we actually realize who really comes out.
That's right. I forgot about the beaver. You're right.
If beavers don't love.
So beaver must be one of your spirit animals, I imagine.
If you're a water harvester in North America, then beaver has to be a totem species in your pantheon
of
biological species.
So in honor of the beaver,
I was just going to say, then I totally agree with what Brock was saying about the beaver, and it's been one of my big inspirations, particularly in the waterways. But another animal, the desert tortoise, has been another inspiring creature of the dry land area, because it will dig a water harvesting basin when it senses the dew point change and it's about to rain, and it'll just sit by that basin, watch it fill, and then drink it until it can't drink anymore, and it'll repeat this in the next rain. So we're mimicking desert tortoises in the upper parts of the watershed, and then we're trying to mimic the beaver when we get lower into the drainages.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. So, given that we are human beings and we live in towns and cities, what I'd like us to do now is, or in houses, I guess, is first of all to share what are your deepest concerns about water in this moment, briefly, because we've had the last two sessions have been a lot about our water situation globally. But just what are you sort of what you track on most, sort of the personal part of your water concerns, and then secondly, if you can paint a picture, each of you, of what it would actually look like if we lived in a water-sane, water-devoted culture or civilization. If you walked into a town or into a house, what would it kind of look like? Give us a visual image of where we're heading. So do you want to start, Brock, with that, and then we'll move on to Laura and Brad?
Oh, goodness. Sure. I mean, I think my biggest concern is just the fact that people don't realize we live on planet water, and the collective behavior of our fossil fuel addiction is so dramatically altering the hydrologic processes on this planet to the detriment of lots of forms of life, amongst other behaviors. And so that's job security for us water harvesters and water literate folks, for sure. And so I think the job security is, how do we think like a watershed? If I was going to, what I want to see is a watershed that from ridgeline to river mouth, from summit to sea, has been resiliently retrofit in all forms of land use. So intensive agriculture and ranching and forestry and urban, suburban, rural landscapes have all repatterned how it is that they modify the space to be a water retaining landscape, a water quality improving, enhancing landscape, a water augmenting landscape, a reusing and reclaiming and reciprocally reverential rehydration revolution, ultimately.
Aho, I love it. You got to turn that into a song and put that on Brad's website.
And I know we're going to get into more details of what those actual nouns and things look like, but that's more the verb of the process of the aspiration.
That's right. That's what we're going to do next. But it's nice to know, it's sort of like I had a shampoo bottle once that said, know the hair you have to get the hair you want. And for some reason, I really took that to heart because it's like, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. Not that it really works with your hair, but in terms of the life that you want to live, it's like know the life you have to get the life you want. And so it's not, you don't want to divorce yourself from your current reality, nor do you want to really have your eye on the goal as sort of part of your daily living. So, Laura, do you want to tell us, you know, living in L.A., let's just say you're in L.A., what would it look like if people in L.A. had a healthy relationship to water?
I think one of the main important things is that it's going to look really different, how we engage with water, depending on where we live, how much we have, what plants we grow, our potential opportunities for using water, and when we should and should not use it. In areas that have more rainfall, there's a lot more water available, and people need to figure out where they live, how much natural water is available from the rain, and how they can try to shape their lives so they fit in tune with that and strike a balance with their area. So in Los Angeles, the green lawn, that's something that just absolutely makes no sense at all. So maybe from where it came from, you know, Western Europe, where it rains enough to keep a lawn, grass lawn green, that would be fine. But here, to have these kind of cultural norms of having green space, green grass, and plants that come from other areas that have more rainfall is something that's acceptable and normal is not a sustainable water future. So we all need to figure out how much water we have and how much we can use, and then make the choices about what we want to irrigate with the things that we have available.
So that the human, you know, the human part of the local environment will look a lot like the environment around it. Our yards, our whatever, or else if we're learn to be careful with our water and harvest rainwater, we can be maybe more creative, but it won't be a wasteful waterscape, is what you're saying.
And then if we for irrigation, when we grow food in our yards, we can use our gray water coming from our showers and our washing machines to irrigate our fruit-producing trees or other food-producing plants.
Yeah, so we're going to get more into that for sure in the next part of our conversation. So what about you, Brad? What's it going to be like in Tucson if people really had a reverent relationship to water?
Well, just before I jump on the juicy positive.
Tell us about the negative first. Sorry, I was jumping ahead of myself.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
a big concern I have is with just existing climate conditions, but in particular with we're expecting with climate change and actually experiencing now, is a greater evaporative loss and a more mobile water. And we already have the potential to lose far more water than we gain in rainfall here in this dry land environment. And as temperatures increase, wind increases, that loss is just going to keep climbing. So what I see as a positive then is, all right, well, if that's the problem, let's turn it into the solution. So how can we minimize that evaporative loss now and in the future? So let's start to shade and shelter as much of the soil as possible. Let's change drainage-like infrastructure into sponge-like living infrastructure that rapidly absorbs, better holds, and is slower to release that water while growing more living food-producing, air-enhancing vegetation. So to basically grow more of the resilient infrastructure, we need to buffer the current and the future extremes. And then within the culture, not only would there be this practice of trying to work with the natural system to enhance all of this living hydrology and ecology, but also taking the local food movement to a whole nother level where it's not just the best local food, but what's the best local water. And I taught in Palestine a little while ago, and one of the other instructors, he had traveled from a nearby village, and he brought with him his olive oil from his own olive trees. He said he never goes anywhere without it because that's his direct route and connection back home to his soil and to his water. He irrigates just with rainwater. He catches in the terraced orchard of his olive grove. And I just so loved that, that he inspired me when I came back to take the rainwater I collect off my roof, in which I drink and cook with and whatnot. So now when I travel, I always start my journey with all my water bottles filled with my rooftop rain to reconnect me with that very direct local source. And I try to travel to visit folks like Brock and Laura, where I can restock my water bottles with their local waters.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a water, I guess it's almost like a, it's sort of like moving through the landscape like a pilgrim, you know. It's a totally different way of being, and sort of, you know, what we're kind of cultivating in Spring of Sustainability is, these are techniques that we all have to make our, we live more in harmony, but we're really talking about a different way of being human, and what does it mean to be an ecologically oriented human being. So many, it's like the whole field of your reality changes when you're ecologically oriented. New opportunities arrive, new little rituals show up, all kinds of ways that we live that express our love of life. So, yeah, water, having your water bottle with special water in it from home, or taking some water home, or, you know, putting it, I'm really into that too. I think it's very important. And every water is a little different. Everybody's water tastes a little different, feels different. You know, we start to love water, and we love it in a kind of intimate way. So the next part of our conversation is going to be about how we get to this vision of health and sanity and an intimate relationship with water. So does anyone want to go first? I mean, I was thinking about starting with you, Laura, just because, you know, you're working in a very local way with these local sort of house systems. Do you want to share something about what it means to, what a gray water system even is?
And sure.
How? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Gray Water Action, the organization that I'm part of, we teach people how to kind of replumb and rethink their homes. So we're very focused on the small-scale things that actions people can take right away or in the near future in a dwelling, collecting rainwater, reusing their gray water, waterless composting toilets. So we teach people how to build these simple and affordable systems, mainly gray water, because when in a lot of urban situations, you're going to get kind of the most bang for your buck with a gray water system in terms of quantity of water for the lowest cost and lowest barriers. Though, of course, it depends on your particular situation, which system may be the most practical place to begin. But we teach people how to build these simple systems. We also train people to be installers. So people who maybe aren't as hands-on can find someone who is more hands-on and more skilled to hire to install them in their home.
So in terms of how much water, like one of the things I've noticed, we use well over 100 water, you know, gallons of water per day in our house. And where is that water mostly going towards? Do you have
So in general, most homes use about half the water inside the home and about half the water outside in the landscape. So of course, there's large variation depending on who you are and your habits. And in the home, the biggest water users are the toilet, the showers, and the washing machine. So if we don't use water for our toilet, if we look at waterless composting toilets, you can totally cut out that source of water, and then you also can create organic humus and be rebuilding soil instead of polluting water. And then with our gray water sources coming from the showers and the washing machines and the sinks, we can use that water for irrigation. Washing machines are usually the easiest. They can be installed relatively simply without even changing the plumbing of a house to direct the water outside for irrigation.
And so do you also work with regulations that sometimes it can be quite difficult to get the city to agree to let you install those kinds of systems, or is that changing now?
It is changing. Yes, codes are not always supportive of sustainable practices, and that is a big barrier that needs to change a lot more. But it has been changing recently. In California, a few years ago, there was a code change that now allows a legal system from a washing machine. It doesn't alter the plumbing, so you're collecting water right from the discharge hose of the machine. And if you follow some basic health and safety guidelines, you can install that system in your home legally with no permit. So it's a huge plus. And now after that, a lot of water districts and cities have begun promoting these systems. In some places, you can even get an incentive, free parts, free classes, a lot of support. And in other places, you can just do it without being in fear of breaking the law or any potential consequences from that.
Wow. So where could people learn about where that's happening in their area, especially where it's supportive, and how people could maybe get more support for doing that in their areas? It's just such an important thing if cities would let local people take on their water problems.
Greywater Action, our website, we do keep some of that up to date. There is probably the best thing to do is for people to contact their own water district and find out. The states that have more friendly regulations for greywater are Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Oregon, and Washington have codes that are more recent that are improved from their prior codes or lack of codes. Wyoming has a code. There's a handful of other states, but in most states in the country still don't really have supportive regulations. So if people are in those states, they have the important job of engaging with their regulators and working on a policy change to support these systems.
Great, great. We might get back to you about a couple things, but I want to make sure everyone has a chance to do an input. So Brock, tell us about how people can get to this vision that you had painted for us.
I totally agree with Laura on all of the policy issues, the realm of legalizing sustainability, if you will, and having been in that subgroup of folks with Laura and many others that worked on that California policy change. If the barriers to implementation in our society are actual bureaucratic and legal barriers because of ecological illiteracy, then it's hard to implement sustainable solutions. So we have to participate in the politics. If all politics are local, all water is local as well, and local water politics, as Mark Twain famously said about California's water politics, is whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over, and we have to move beyond fighting over water and embracing water in a collaborative way. So that's why I call watersheds basins of relations as we get back to there. So I think I really am interested, and I know Brad and Laura, all of us having worked together for so many years, I think recognize and value the idea of what is your personal water budget and your home's water budget, and can you actually evaluate your home, the land around it at whatever level it is, and not everyone has that capacity, but conceptually, how much rainfall falls on that property, on the roof? What quality is it? How can we intercept it? How can we put it back in the land? How can we hold it? How can we put it in the tank? How can we reuse it? How can we recycle the gray water on site? How can we stop using water? How can we stop defecating in the water cycle and start defecating in the carbon cycle with compost toilets to sequester carbon and grow plants and solve two opportunities in one swoop here? And so that ecological living you brought up before, where you actually are engaged as an active participant, as a keystone species in your local hydrologic cycle, from rain to roof to reuse. And so that the set of tools in that toolbox of roof water harvesting, of groundwater recharge and rain gardens, of gray water reuse, of compost toilets, of low flow retrofits for appliances, for growing your food on site versus importing it, so we don't even have the virtual water, certainly not supporting corporatized bottled water privatization schemes, and then participating at the larger level in your own watershed to restore the integrity of the living watershed system, your local stream, your local uplands, your native vegetation. There's just a multiple scales of which we can participate, but at some point it's about you owning it as a bipedal sack of saline solution that's mostly water, and really getting clean about what goes in and what goes out and how you can beneficially be in relationship to the water cycle versus detrimentally.
I mean, we really are keystone species, so beginning to own that and
we should act like it.
We should act
instead
like
of
exactly.
Our behavior's been in a degradative disturbance versus regenerative disturbance, and we have to reclaim our relationship as actual, the potential to behave as a collective species in ways that support and create conditions for life and redefine sustainability as our ability to sustain the cycles of life. And the water cycle is the primary cycle we're talking about here. No water, no life.
Right. And so it's sort of like, you know, just reclaiming ourselves as water beings as opposed to Americans, for example, or whatever.
That would be great. Gender.
Wouldn't it be great? Because then suddenly you begin to think differently. It's like water is your primary affiliation, and from that place, many other things can take shape and grow. And so, Brad, tell us more about that part of it. What can, you know, how can we make help other things take shape around our relationship to water? Because I know you work with the economy, with food systems, and with what you call sort of the larger systemic, what you call the overlapping systems that we are dependent on.
Yeah, well, I think a real big thing is to, you know, just get out into these systems when they're really happening and observe them and see how can we better engage with it. So, for example, when it rains, a great step would be rather than going indoors, get outdoors and get out in the rain and check out where is the water flowing? What's it doing? Is it infiltrating and generating life? Is it too quickly running off, creating flooding downstream or maybe some erosion? And just engage with that and try and tap into what is working and see how could you build on that? How could you mimic that? So, you know, one of my favorite pastimes is to be running around my neighborhood in a bathing suit and a shovel in my hand in a big storm. And it's great to see more neighbors starting to join in with that. Because there's no funner time, and it's so immediate. You see immediate feedback of, well, if I move a little bit of dirt here, wow, I start to retain and infiltrate the water rather than draining it. And you can make real quick adjustments, and it's awesome. While at the same time, you know, when it's raining, we can be out and about. Well, also when it's sunny, we can be out and about. But this time, rather than tracking water flow, we can be tracking the path of the sun in the sky. And let's see how we can work with that. Let's tap into the fact that the sun here in the continental United States is rising and setting to the south of due east and west in the winter months, while it's rising and setting to the north of due east and west in the summer months. And in the winter, the sun's lower in the sky. In the summer, the sun's higher in the sky. So just to say, starting to make these simple observations, we can start to orient our homes, other buildings, in such a way that the long wall faces south and gets maximum winter sun exposure for maximum free heat and light and power. And we have the short walls facing the rising and setting sun to the east and the west. So in the hotter months, we have less of that rising and setting sun hitting the walls because it's a shorter or smaller wall surface facing that hot season sun. And just by doing this, we can dramatically reduce the temperatures, the summer temperatures in our buildings, while dramatically enhancing and increasing the winter temperatures in our buildings with no mechanical heating or cooling systems. We can use daylight rather than artificial light. We can turn our homes and businesses into their own power plants by doing renewable solar power production as opposed to burning coal and importing that. And it turns out that about almost 40% of the fresh water withdrawn in the United States is for thermoelectric power generation.
Really?
So wow. Almost 40%. And of that water, we can look to about, you know, I'm sorry, not the water, of the energy that we consume in the U.S., about 37 is for residential uses, 36 for commercial, and 27% for industrial. So if we start to reduce our power consumption, or at least reduce the power that has been produced at thermoelectric power plants and so on, we can dramatically reduce the water consumption at those plants, while at the same time creating homes and neighborhoods that renewably produce resources rather than consume them. And it all starts by just observing, how does the sun move through the sky, and how do we build and live in relationship with that understanding rather than just ignoring it?
You are really describing a kind of intimacy, and it definitely reminds me of kids in the sandbox, you know, just getting gloppy and whatever, but also just what it would be like to really begin to feel yourself as homo ecologicus, ecologicas, whatever you want to say, you know, just sort of an ecological human being that feels the wind and the sun and how the house would be, and just a completely different way of living and so much more creative, and even, and I'm just sensing so much more joy in it, you know, not just laying a grid over nature, but really beginning to blend with the forms and the patterns of nature. So if anyone, any of our listeners have questions, you can type them into the webcast or press 1 on your phone, and you can ask Brad or Laura or Brock any question you have about issues of water in your area, or questions you have about what they've said, or anything. We have a whole pack of expertise right here, so please ask any questions. We're moving towards, and in some ways you've already given some practical steps to care for water, but actions that matter, and any final thoughts you all might have about what people can do now. And I was thinking of, I was thinking about just keeping going with you, Brad, because you had spoken about how we can do this very economically and cheaply, how we can learn to care for water and for being involved with the sun very economically. Do you want to say anything about the $30? Was it for $30 or less?
Yeah. So how can we start to better engage with our local waters for $30 or less? Well, right off the bat, let's just buy or just borrow a shovel and get out in the rain, and then let's turn our mound-like landscapes and landforms that drain the water away, and let's convert them into more bowl-like shapes that retain and infiltrate that water. And then let's use same shovel to then plant the living pumps of vegetation, be they trees, shrubs, or what have you, that will then uptake that water that has been harvested and banked in the soil, and it makes that water available in the form of shade, shelter, beauty, food, fruit, and so on. As far as that $30 again, invest in or salvage a bucket. And when you're taking a shower and you're waiting for the water to heat up, if you don't yet have the gray water system, you can fill that bucket with the water as you're waiting for it to heat up, and then stand over the bucket when you shower. So the water hitting your body, most of it goes into the bucket. And then flush the toilet with your gray water instead of flushing it with drinking water. Of course, okay, I'm going to push the envelope a little bit here. If you're in more of a rural setting, you can use the same shovel to dig a cat hole. And now you don't have to use any water when you relieve yourself. Or better yet, create a compost toilet so that it would be more easy to readily harvest the safely composted and transformed nutrients at the end of that composting process. Another great strategy would be purchase my book, read about how to do this stuff, purchase Laura's upcoming book, or if you want to do it for free, go onto the Occidental Arts and Ecology website and download a whole bunch of their free documents that give you free tips on what you can implement right now. And in terms of the sun, how can we start harvesting and embracing the power of the sun for $30 or less? Well, you can start by investing in a clothesline rather than using a gas dryer or an electric dryer. And you also get UV sterilization of your clothes. It'll be fresher, way more awesome. You can look to opening your curtains of the south-facing windows on winter days and closing them at night. That way you're grabbing that winter sun coming through your window, and then you're retaining the heat you caught in the day by closing the curtain at night. Have a campfire outside. What? Why do a campfire? So maybe you'll look up at the sky and see the stars and be reminded, whoa, we live on a planet. And you're re-engaged with that. You're reminded of that. And wow, we better live in a way that enhances rather than destroys the life on the planet, because we don't have another planet. And maybe if you look up to those stars, you remember, wow, the sun, that's the closest star. That's the most local star. And how do we engage with that? And then you start tapping into the daytime observations of the sun and getting into correct orientations or reorientations of buildings if you ever add on or put in awnings or whatnot that are appropriately sized to capture the winter sun but shade out the summer sun. Put in a trellis on the appropriate side of or wall of your house and grow up some vegetation for passive cooling and shading on the east or west sides of your house. Plant a tree in the appropriate spot so it shades you when you want shade, but still gives you access to sun in the winter when you want that sun. And set that tree up within a water harvesting basin so it captures roof runoff so it's irrigated for free. Maybe get supplemental water from a gray water system so you get more fruit production. So you're getting food, passive cooling and heating, a climbing tree, better air, and so much more. And it's something that you can celebrate now, and all those that follow you will celebrate and be so thankful that you set that system up, because you're making life better for them as well. Because it's all about engaging with and being part of enhancing the living system.
Yeah, right. And that is so true. And, you know, when we learn all this information about how difficult things are for other life forms or what's in store for our future, just hearing that, we could just capture what you had said, and people can really take notes about each of those things. That is a way to counteract that feeling of helplessness and despair and, you know, just that demoralization feeling when you think about how much work we have to do. It's all going to be done with these local, loving actions that we can take now, next week, over the next year. Laura and Brad, would you like to add? How about Laura? Do you want to add anything to? Thank you so much, Brad. To what Brad said, and Brock and Laura, would you like to add? Laura, I guess go ahead. We'll start with you. We just have a few more minutes, so.
Yeah, if people don't already know where their water comes from and the path it takes and what's impacted along the way, that's super important. Just to really solidify the importance of why saving your local water is important and using it respectfully and sustainably, and then knowing how much water you use each day. Like everybody, if you're asked how many gallons to use a day, it's really important to know the answer to that question. And if you don't get a water bill and you can't do it that route, you can easily figure out how much water you use by knowing how much flows out of your shower head. If it's too much, you can get a lower flow one. There's ones you can get for 1.5 gallons, you know, per 1.5 gallons per minute versus the older, like, 2.5 gallon a minute shower heads. So all the efficiency changes that are very simple and very low cost are super important. And then figuring out how to create the systems to reuse that water or not use it at all, like with a waterless toilet. And that really is impacted by if people are homeowners or renters, or do they live in an apartment building, or do they have a yard. I mean, there's a lot of factors that's going to influence what are the best things in each situation to do. But in any living situation, there's always a variety of options, and a lot of them are very affordable.
That's right. In any living situation, we can take control and care for our water, and that is the main lesson I wanted us to walk away with today. And Brock, I wonder if you can conclude with something. You know, I'm also very curious about composting toilets. I don't know if people even know what they are. And are there rules against installing them in municipalities, and is this going to be changing? You know, describe a composting toilet to us as part of our concluding actions that we can take.
Well, I mean, at a simple level, you're creating a compost pile, which is a blend of carbon and nitrogen and biology and moisture and temperature, and allow natural processes to decompose complex molecules of plant matter or human number two. And so there are, as far as the legality on that, that's one of those really it depends answers, because every state, every county, every city has different regulations and requirements or legality and such. And there's a lot of very active work going on. I know Brad and others in Arizona are very active in trying to change compost toilet laws, or at least allow compost toilets to be an acceptable device in Arizona, folks in Oregon. We're working on it here in California as well. Obviously, there's a significant concern with pathogens and health and public health and safety and that sort of issue. Although, ironically, what we find is with centralized sewage systems where we put it in water and make it, quote, go away and then treat it, and then we have to get rid of the, quote, effluent and make it go away, the amount of contamination of water supplies from centralized sewage systems is showing itself to not be as effective overall as we might think. So So there's a rethink on that, and again, this is it's a complicated subject, but the act of actually allowing life to take your waste and turn it into a resource and transform that from waste equaling food for another biological process of bacteria and fungus, that's not complicated. Life's been doing that for several billion years, and we just have to do biological mimicry or ecological emulation and create a container, such as a bucket, where we contribute, and then we add carbon and moisture, and then there are different ways, whether we can heat it up thermophilically or allow it to molder, and there's different types of compost toilets, and people would have to look that up. There's many technologies, from very expensive systems to very affordable systems, such as a 5-gallon bucket and some wood shavings and a secondary place to allow it to compost further, like the humanure toilet design. So that can be very accessible, and it can be done in a very safe way that ensures public health and safety while actually increasing the resiliency and carbon sequestration, the ability to grow plants while we save water and energy simultaneously.
It's the new black gold, you know?
It's the old black gold. It's the original
black gold.
It's the original black gold of humus in the carbon cycle as carbon-based life forms versus the new black gold of fossil fuels, which is the toxic black gold. Blue gold and black gold come together with carbon and H2O, and those create conditions for life. And so let's recouple a natural water cycle with a carbon cycle in a healthy way and get off the addiction of combusting fossil fuels and greenhouse gas-emitting toxins.
So it's all so doable, and it's local, and I just, you know, we just need to remember that most of the solutions to our global issues that we're facing can happen in our local communities. And so I hope everybody on the call and who are listening to the recordings later takes a moment to go and check out these different websites that we mentioned of Brad Lancaster's work, Brock Dolman, and Laura Allen. And just so many important and new and also ancient ways of living in balance with nature that we need to reclaim as part of our lifestyle. So you can go to springofsustainability.com/actions where you'll find more things you can do to just be in tune with nature and to live in a community healthy way. And next week we're going to be doing a whole week around building an economy that works. And as we've been learning, and when the economy is divorced from the living systems of the planet, we are in big trouble. So as with water, it's not that difficult to turn towards a sane way of living economically. It will take a little effort and imagination and community, but we can do this. So join us on Monday to have a conversation with David Corton about how to build an economy that works. It's a crucial conversation, one that we will all benefit from. And let's see, and if you want to continue to listen to this session again, I know I'm going to want to listen to this session again because there are so many great ideas that the three of you have shared with us. You can go and get an upgrade package, and it's not that expensive, and then you have access to all of the different conversations we've had over these 9 weeks and forever, and also to share them with others. So please consider an upgrade. It supports our work here, and it would support furthering making sustainability a way of life for all of us. And do you guys each have maybe one or two sentences to conclude? I mean, really kind of just to send us off with a sense of our love for water, just to inspire us and keep us going. Laura, do you want to start?
Sure. Just do one thing, a bucket. Getting a bucket is so simple, and you really get to see the water you use and see how it can easily be reused.
Yeah, you know, I use all my bath water to flush my toilet. That's something you can do right now, you know, and it's a great excuse to take a bath because, I need to fill my bathtub for my toilet. And this is another reason to take a bath. So enjoy the water and then use the water. So thanks, Laura. Brad, what about you? One last thought just to send us all off.
Yeah, so just think about how might you best be able to plant the rain. And that might be as simple as a simple little basin with some vegetation and organic mulch. Because to maximize any harvest, we have to begin with the planting. So let's plant that rain to maximize the water harvest and the potential of what that water can produce.
Great. You know, I'm just realizing because I've been working on a small computer that I'm missing the questions that are coming in. And there's two questions, and I really want to get them. And I know we're going over the time, but I'm going to take a risk of calling on general PIN with an area code of 424. You have a question for our guest? Make it really quick because I'm going over. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, I'll try and make it quick. We're definitely not living in harmony with the Earth community, but I think before we can do that, we have to live in harmony with each other, the human community. And that's on the large scale globally, but with each other, our families, and where we work. And to do that, we have to start doing what we used to do most of our evolution, is live and work in groups. I'm wondering with your guests what their experience working with the basic element as water, as well as the way they're living in eco-communities, permaculture, what is that, what can they tell us about living and working in community, and then giving us hope that that way of living and working can provide us with solutions? And this is Andrew in Los Angeles. Thank you.
Well, Andrew in L.A., actually Laura lives in an eco-community in L.A., and I don't know if I can really get our guests going on that. That would be a whole show in itself. But the very last week is going to be more about that. It's sustainability as a transformative way of life. So I hope you tune into that. Just due to time, I don't think we can really answer that question. But even putting it out there is important, and I think in some ways the answer is already embedded in the question. You know, get to know your neighbors and get together and create solutions together. So there's one more question, area code 650. Would you like to ask our guests a quick question? Maybe it can be quickly answered.
Yeah, I just have a quick comment. Brad talked about problem into solution, shade and shelter, the soil and that. Basically, all the things he mentioned are reversing the heat island effect as well in community.
The heat island effect. Yeah, that you mean what you feel like when you're in the city, how much hotter it is in the country?
Right,
or
right.
What is that?
Having black asphalt, you know, baking, you by turning the plants absorbing and using that sunlight, and as it goes back as evaporation, it's cooling. So, you know, that cools, that creates a local microclimate, a pattern of local microclimates, and then a larger general climate.
And global warming is basically Earth Island heat effect. It's the same thing
right.
at that local level to up to the planetary level.
Right.
Exactly. So, Brad, do you want to send this out?
In this globally, we can help solve a lot.
So Brad, send us out with a thought about locally, locally counteracting the hot island effect, and inspiring words, and maybe make a comment on our guest comment. Thanks.
Well, they're right on. Anything we can do to reduce evaporative loss is great, and if we start infiltrating that water within sponge-like living systems, way better off. And to kind of morph that into the previous question, I'll just say, as Laura and Braca pointed out, if we can engage with, hey, where does our water come from? What's our local watershed? That's a naturally bounded community. And water is an awesome unifier because we're all dependent on it. We're all walking, talking water. So whatever people's political predisposition, water is a great way to find common ground and an excuse to build a bridge to enhance life for all of us.
And you start taking a positive action, you know, even just a simple act of getting, you know, any simple act is going to be good for a lot of reasons because all of these problems are interconnected. So you just start doing one positive action and suddenly it reverberates and it leads you to other ones. So the important message is to just begin to take one action and then keep going. So thank everybody very much for your devotion, for your work and devotion to water especially. And may we, you know, become who we, you know, become the change we want to see in a way that's fun and inspiring and involves others in our community. And anyway, thank you all very much for joining us.